John Melman is going to speak to us on new things in cardiology. John? There he is. Welcome, Dr. Melman.
Thank you all so much for having me. I'm actually an electrophysiologist at MacKD, one of three there, and we sort of run the arrhythmia service. And the topic, obviously, is what's new in my specialty. And my pointer is, can I advance the slide?
It's a green button somewhere.
The one right in the middle, the big one, there it is. Okay. So, in terms of what's new in my specialty, some would say that the whole field of electrophysiology is a very young and new one. Pacemakers have been around for a few decades, but really most of the major developments in the field that have made it what it is are relatively new. The first defibrillator, implantable defibrillator, was only first placed in 1980. Board certification has only really been around for just over 20 years. I'm really sort of what some would say the second or really third generation of practicing electrophysiologists. RF ablation, treating arrhythmias by ablating certain arrhythmogenic foci in the heart, even younger than that, and that actually makes up the bulk of our practice nowadays. And over that time, what electrophysiologists do has really sort of dramatically expanded. So the first electrophysiologist would take patients with refractory arrhythmias, give them a drug, try to fibrillate the heart. If that doesn't work, try a different drug, and that was sort of the field for its first 20 to 30 years. Nowadays, our practice scope has obviously dramatically expanded. We manage and implant all manner of pacing and defibrillating devices, so pacemakers, defibrillators. We now have defibrillators with one, two, or three leads, what are called resynchronization devices. We do those as well. The management of device infections is really sort of a surgical field, extracting these things and managing device malfunctions. Some of you may be familiar with our implantable loop recorders, patients with sort of rare episodes of syncope that you're worried about that don't come along that often. These devices are now smaller than your pinky, take about a minute to implant, essentially like placing a depot Prevera shot, and the patients are just monitored remotely from home. Catheter ablation is what I'll sort of focus on today. We can treat all manner of cardiac arrhythmias with ablation. And even newer are these sort of very rare hereditary arrhythmias. We think about long QT syndrome, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. These things sort of pop up once in a blue moon, often present with arrhythmias, and they sort of by default fallen under the purview of electrophysiologists. But today, like I said, we'll talk about catheter ablation. So catheter ablation really involves placing catheters in the heart, finding a certain focus you're interested in, and then performing ablation. Ablation basically is like performing electrocautery inside the heart. The first 10-20 years of this was actually a pretty, I guess you could say, primitive by today's standards kind of approach. Do I have a? Okay, so this is a sort of a schematic of the heart, and the first procedures people did was basically ablating the AV node. And this was basically done for intractable atrial fibrillation. I'm sure everyone's come across these patients. You just cannot get the heart rate under control no matter what you do. And sort of the ultimate intervention you can do for that is ablating the AV node, and then no matter how much atrial fibrillation they have, their ventricular rate will be controlled. So you'd put a pacemaker in, you'd put this catheter that's sitting right there where that circle is at the AV node, and you would basically give the patient a DC shock. So the same way we defibrillate someone in the emergency room, you do charge clear and you shock them, except for you shock them with this catheter inside the heart. And when you did that, they would go from atrial fibrillation, you'd deliver the shock, the guy would basically jump off the table, and hopefully you develop heart block and a controlled ventricular rate. And this was, like I said, the first 10-20 years of electrophysiology was how we treated arrhythmias. Nowadays, we obviously do it in a much more controlled manner. Anybody who does, is either a surgeon here or does, you know, minor surgical procedures, knows about the Bovie, the electrocautery that we use, and you sort of have this metal probe. You pass an electric current between your probe and the grounding pad on the patient. You can see the electricity sort of arc between your catheter and the tissue, and you can actually cut tissue. You can use it to control bleeding by sort of fulgurating the tissue with that electrical current. Now, that's a very effective way of controlling bleeding, controlling tissue during surgery. If you're doing this with a catheter on the inside of your heart, you probably want something a little bit more controlled than that. And this is how we do it. This is an ablation catheter. And what we're doing is ablating a piece of chicken. And so it's, if you look, you actually kind of have to look at this for a while, but you can see the tissue sort of turning white under that catheter. And we sort of very slowly, in a very controlled manner, deliver the electricity. So if you're doing this in a beating heart, you'd rather have this than a bovie kind of arcing across, obviously. And just to show you right there is that sort of cooked piece of meat as we deliver the electricity. So how do we do this? I just wanted to give everyone a sense of what your patients go through if you do refer them for ablation, how we actually do these procedures. So the way we actually see inside the heart during a procedure is with fluoroscopy. For those not familiar, this is basically an X-ray image. And we have a camera that takes these pictures in real time, and we can sort of see things moving inside the heart. It is X-ray-based imaging, so we're irradiating the patient and ourselves during this procedure. It's really the only way of looking inside the heart and seeing in real time how the catheters are moving and where they are in the heart. But as you can imagine, if you're doing a very complex case and you need to ablate a lot of different sites in the heart, it can be hard to sort of keep track of where exactly things are in the heart as you're moving these catheters along. So this is what it actually looks like. You can see the heart sort of beating. You can see the catheters where they are, and with a lot of practice, those of you guys who are maybe familiar with this recognize that circle is the tricuspid annulus, and there's a catheter over going from the right atrium over to the left atrium in the coronary sinus. There's another catheter in the right atrium, and we actually have an ablation catheter. Now, obviously, you can see just looking at this, if you're doing a lot of ablation, can you really tell where your catheter is or has been to the millimeter? It's not the most accurate and most effective way of doing it. So one of the major developments in our field over the past couple of years has been what's called electroanatomic imaging. And this is how we do all our procedures now. So this is a system that actually tracks where the catheters are in three dimensions inside the heart as we move it. It tracks where our catheters have been, where we've done ablation. It doesn't require X-rays. In some cases, this is done very rarely, but pregnant women who have intractable arrhythmias and there's no other way to get them through the pregnancy safely, and it's a real problem, we can actually do an entire procedure with zero X-ray use using just these systems. And I just want to show you exactly what it is that I'm talking about, what it is that we're doing. So the screen on your left there shows you that X-ray image, and the screen on the right that's moving is an electroanatomic image. So what we're doing is moving the catheter inside the heart, okay? And as we're doing it, see this sort of grayish shell that is swept out? That is a computer tracking exactly where that catheter has been. And what we're really doing is creating what we call a shell. It's sort of the inside surface of, in this case, this catheter is in the coronary sinus coming from the right atrium, which you'll see here in a minute. And as we move the catheter around, we sort of build that shell. And over the course of a few minutes of mapping, you can see we're sort of building out the coronary sinus. This is the superior vena cava. And as we move the catheter, you can see we continue to sort of sweep out this shell. This is in a matter of minutes, we can generate the entire shape of the inside of a right atrium. And I'll just sort of skip ahead, and you can see it's sort of starting to take the shape of what you would expect a right atrium to look like. And by comparison, this was the initial image, right? So again, this is this catheter is that catheter, and we're looking dead on through the tricuspid annulus, and the SVC's sort of up here. Now, as we do this, the system is actually not only tracking where the catheters are in three dimensions, but this is the case of a patient with atrial flutter. Now, those of you who are familiar will remember atrial flutter is a circuit of electricity going around the tricuspid annulus. So as you move your catheter around and as you touch each point on the wall, the software not only tracks where these catheters are, but it records the timing of the electrical activity at each point. Okay, this is what we call activation mapping. So while we're building this, the system is actually tracking that for us, and this is what we end up with after we do this mapping. And hopefully this will play. It does. So you see this red wavefront? That is going around the tricuspidians. We're seeing in real time this arrhythmia, which in this case is atrial flutter. This whole thing for an arrhythmia like this takes maybe 10 to 15 minutes. And most of the time, like I said, we use almost no x-rays to irradiate the patient. The structure right there is what we call the cavotricuspid isthmus. So this is the tricuspid annulus, again in the right atrium, SVC, in the coronary sinus, and this is the IVC. Now in between those two, this isthmus is the narrowest sort of part of this circuit. And this is the area that we target for ablation in this particular case. For different, every arrhythmia is a little bit different, but this is the area that we're gonna target. So after we build this map, we go ahead. Now, this is the atrial flutter. You can see on the EKG. We put our catheter right on that isthmus and start to ablate. We're now delivering electrical energy, and within a few seconds, you'll see this arrhythmia terminates to sinus rhythm. Okay? And that's how we can treat arrhythmias. Okay? In the early days, this used to be a four-hour procedure or so. This now can be done skin to skin in about an hour. Usually about a minute or two of fluoroscopy time, so very little radiation. In this particular case, ablation of atrial flutter is actually an outpatient procedure. So patient will go home a few hours after we're done. And that's actually the case for the majority of the arrhythmias that we treat. So I showed you a lot of fancy toys and pictures, but how good is all this? How effective are we? So for the majority of arrhythmias, and essentially all these ones in sort of the upper half of this table, our success rates are very high, okay? These are now what we call sort of non-complex ablations. The field has sort of divided itself in what we call complex and not complex arrhythmias, rather arbitrarily. But you can see for the most common arrhythmias that we see, so AV node reentry, patients with Wolff-Parkinson-White who get those arrhythmias, atrial flutter, atrial tachycardias, which you may have some patients that come in with these extremely bothersome episodes, heart can race for days and days, you can get heart failure from this. Our success rates are very, very high. And complication rates are all fairly low. They're generally in this sort of 2 to 5% range, most of which is actually made up of bleeding, bruising, minor hematomas at the sites where we go into the veins, into the femoral veins that don't require any intervention or blood transfusion. The risk of a serious complication is generally much lower than this. For some of the more complex arrhythmias, success rates are more variable. So ventricular tachycardia, whether it's what we call idiopathic VT in people with otherwise normal hearts or who've had ischemic heart disease, these are sicker patients, they have comorbidities, the risks of recurrences and success rates are a little bit lower. For the rest of this talk, I'm gonna focus a little bit on atrial fibrillation. Now, why talk about atrial fibrillation? Well, it's, first of all, the most common arrhythmia. I'm sure that most of you all probably see in clinical practice, especially in older patients. And it's a field where the ablation outcomes have sort of shown the most improvement over the last couple of years. It's gone from really sort of an experimental kind of procedure to a pretty routine one, and actually one of the most common arrhythmias that we ablate in practice. Many of you are probably familiar with this. Like I said, very, very common. The most common arrhythmia that we deal with and probably that you all see. It's a very interesting arrhythmia. It's patients can come in absolutely miserable from this. They feel their heart racing, the loss of atrial kick and AV synchrony can really debilitate some people. Shortness of breath, low energy, fatigue, all these symptoms can be associated with it. Some people can actually go into heart failure from atrial fibrillation if it's not controlled and managed appropriately. Some patients, though, are completely asymptomatic to their atrial fibrillation. And as I tell my patients, we really don't know why. There are patients that, as you know, walk around with this for years, have no idea, and there are patients who can't get out of bed on the days that they have atrial fibrillation. But we know that the stroke risk from atrial fibrillation is considerable. The estimates are about 15% of all strokes in the United States are attributable to atrial fibrillation one way or another. And the incidence is even higher when you just look at the older populations where atrial fibrillation is more common. What we call cryptogenic stroke, patients that come in with strokes and we don't know why, now with the use of implantable loop recorders and careful monitoring, a significant proportion of those are due to atrial fibrillation. So what is atrial fibrillation? It's one of those things that you sort of, you know it when you see it, right? We know the atria, instead of their usual pumping activity, are fibrillating, just completely chaotic activity. When we see it on an EKG, most of us have probably seen it. You see this irregular QRS complexes. Instead of P waves, which sort of mark regular atrial activity, you see this kind of, you know, chaotic, wavy baseline kind of thing. And that's the hallmark of atrial fibrillation. Now, how do we treat it? So many of you are probably familiar with the two approaches we use, rate control or rhythm control, right? So rate control means we just slow the heart rate, you give an AV nodal blocker, calcium channel blocker, beta blocker. We used to give a lot of digoxin. It has a downside of killing people reproducibly in a lot of trials, so we shy away from it now. Rhythm control means giving antiarrhythmic drugs. That's what it used to be. That was what you were limited to. So medications that generally mostly cardiologists probably prescribe, things like flecainide, propafenone, sotalol, amiodarone, or catheter ablation, which, like I said, is the newest contribution to this field and growing rapidly. So this is a trial that's probably influenced more of clinical practice in atrial fibrillation than any other one. The trial was called AFFIRM. And the idea was they randomized patients, are you going to do rhythm control or rate control? And I'll spare you guys the details of all the enrollment criteria and so on, but here's basically what they found. There's no difference in mortality if you randomize patients to rate control or rhythm control. I'll just mention really quick that this population was a relatively old population, older than what we tend to see in our clinical practice. An average age of 70, no one was under 65. Relatively sick patients, at least one other stroke risk factor. A lot of these guys were put on amiodarone, which we know is not a great long-term drug, but can be used in the short term. And there was a lot of crossover because patients were symptomatic with their atrial fibrillation. Now, not only these guys were, you see this p-value is 0.08, so really these guys got lucky who make the antiarrhythmic drugs because there was a little bit increased mortality in the rhythm control group. Why did they have that? Well, all these drugs do cause QT prolongation, and once in a blue moon, someone gets enough that they get torsade, right? Which is not a good thing. A lot more hospitalizations in the drug control group, a lot more torsade in that group. So when this trial came out, it sort of established the standard of care is you can choose rate versus rhythm control. Most of us think that the reason why there was that trend toward increased mortality with rhythm control was that this trial came out before the era of catheter ablation. So these drugs they kill people. They're a problem. We worry a lot. We load a lot of these drugs as an inpatient. Sotalol, dofetilide are loaded as an inpatient. They can interact with a lot of drugs. They're a real problem. In addition, this trial, like I said, was used in older people. Symptomatic patients got to cross over to rhythm control. So in symptomatic younger patients who are making up a higher and higher population, a percentage of the AFib population, this doesn't quite apply. In retrospective analyses, it turns out that patients who you can maintain in sinus rhythm did much better, had a lower mortality. You can see right here. And patients who ended up staying on a rhythm control and maintaining sinus rhythm had a lower mortality as well. So it's really the sickest patients who you can't control who were left on an antiarrhythmic who shouldn't have the increased mortality. In addition, as I said, some patients, particularly the ones who are really symptomatic with their AFib, derive a lot of benefit from being put into sinus rhythm, whether you use a drug or catheter ablation. So these are outcomes. This is the SF-36, it's sort of a quality of life scale with a bunch of different categories. And across all these categories, when you do catheter ablation on these patients, there's a significant improvement. Now, the first thing you'll notice, obviously, is 12 months of follow-up is not quite a lot. This field is young enough and evolving fast enough that we don't have a lot of trials with a lot of long-term follow-up. But in trials that have gone out, this trial actually went out up to 2 years. And you can see that there are sustained quality of life across several different measures on the scale. And that's a consistent thing in study after study. Here they kind of graph it, sort of palpitations, tired, shortness of breath, dizzy, things that really, for patients that we see back in clinic again and again with their atrial fibrillation, can make a really significant difference. As the field has evolved, we're now ablating patients who previously we thought were too sick to undergo AFib ablation. I'll show you guys a little bit about how we do these studies, how we do the ablation, but even patients with heart failure, if you end up doing ablation on them, a lot of these metrics seem to improve. Their VO2 uptake, if you can get them into sinus rhythm, gets better. In patients who are put into rhythm control, put into rate control versus catheter ablation, you can see there's a real marked trend in their peak VO2. So again, this is sort of an exercise capacity metric that we use in cardiology on exercise stress tests to assess how our patients are doing. Some of you guys may be familiar. This is, again, going back to that initial slide that I showed you when we do that AV node ablation. So when nothing else is working for their AFib, they have bad heart failure, you can always ablate the AV node, give them a pacemaker, and control their heart rate. Turns out, if you try to at least control their AFib with a pulmonary vein isolation, the PVI, the catheter ablation of AFib, they do better. Several different metrics show that. You can see that their ejection fractions improve, their 6-minute walk test, which is another sort of metric of how they're doing symptomatically, gets better. So we're doing more and more catheter ablation of atrial fibrillation rather than consigning some of our sickest patients to a lifetime of heart block and pacemaker dependence. Okay, how do we ablate AFib? So I put this in quotes because atrial fibrillation, unlike that flutter that I showed you, we find this one circuit, we have this isthmus, we zap it, done. Same thing works for Wolf, Parkinson, White. We find the pathway, zap it, done. AFib doesn't really work that way. AFib, these whole atria are fibrillating, and there's no sort of one site you're going to ablate and get rid of it. But here's what you do. We basically target the areas of the atrium that are initiating or triggering atrial fibrillation. Now, about 20 years ago, a group in France found that people who have paroxysmal atrial fibrillation, the kind that comes and goes, the initiation is caused by PACs that come from the pulmonary veins. Okay? This is, I'll spare you guys all the detailed electrical recordings, but this here is a PAC coming from a catheter that's placed in the pulmonary vein, and it puts this patient into atrial fibrillation. And the vast majority of the PACs that cause atrial fibrillation come from the pulmonary veins. So when we do this procedure, the reason why we call it an AF ablation, sometimes we call it a PVI or pulmonary vein isolation, is because we're actually electrically isolating the pulmonary veins from the rest of the heart. So how do we do it? So the traditional approach was using that radio frequency catheter that I showed you. So you saw we kind of put it on that, we showed you the piece of meat and turn it on. And you know, you can go point by point and go around those pulmonary veins. And I'll show you the newer approach that we're using at MCKD that we think is a whole lot more effective and safer for patients, frankly. So I'm not going to go through, I'm running a little short on time here, but just to show you kind of how effective this procedure is it 100% effective? It is not. And that's something that sort of gave AF ablation quite a bad reputation in its early days, because if the ablation is not done well, it's a technically fairly demanding procedure, and if it's not done in appropriately selected patients, quite frankly, so patients who've been in AFib for years, those are not patients that are going to do well with this procedure. But in appropriately selected patients, you can see what our outcomes are here. So first of all, you'll notice that outcomes are better with catheter than with antiarrhythmic drugs, and depending on the trial that you look at, anywhere between 60 to 70% end up completely AFib-free off an antiarrhythmic. Those are the numbers generally that I quote my patients. 60 to 70% chance of having no AFib going forward from being someone who's hopefully highly symptomatic is who I select for my ablations. Of the rest of the patients, of those remaining 30 to 40%, a significant percentage have a marked reduction in how much AFib they have. And that's why you saw those quality of life measures really do go up for symptomatic patients that you ablate. So you don't get rid of every last AFib episode they have, but you make a big difference for them. This is sort of the longest term follow-up we have now. This actually just came out very recently. So 12-year follow-up, and you can see this is sort of the survival curve. And again, it levels out somewhere at about, this is completely free, by the way, so zero recurrence. somewhere at about 60%, 10 years out. Of the rest of these, a lot of these will have a marked improvement in their quality of life. This is just another trial with persistent AFib. I won't belabor the point here. This is just to show you, again, these are among patients who have recurrences of atrial fibrillation. Everyone, or almost everyone, will have a marked reduction in how much atrial fibrillation they have. I just want to skip ahead here and show you how we do ablation at MCKD and show you some of the advantages that our group has. So the traditional way of doing the AFib ablation, like I showed you, was you take this catheter, the radio frequency catheter, and you burn here. Then you move a little bit and you burn here. Then you move a little bit and you burn here. So it looks like that piece of chicken, right? You kind of drag it slowly across the tissues in the left atrium. These two catheters are in the left atrium. Now you might ask how we get into the left atrium. Well, we go up the veins, up to the right atrium. We do a transseptal puncture. So you poke a hole in the intraatrial septum, put two catheters in there, and that's how you do the procedure. So you need one to do the burning, and this one, we call it a lasso catheter, and that kind of tracks how well we're doing isolating the electrical signals from each of the four pulmonary veins, okay? So what you do is you burn point by point, and then when you're done doing that, those electrical signals here from the pulmonary veins that were initiating atrial fibrillation can't get out because you created this line of radio frequency lesions in the left atrium, okay? Now, what we're doing, and this is a newer technique, and it's really caught on nationwide, is what's called a cryoballoon ablation. So instead of using these two catheters, we use one, and this is the catheter. You can see it here. So this catheter has a balloon on the end of it. So we put this catheter in the left atrium, blow up this balloon, and with this balloon, you plug the hole, the ostium of the pulmonary vein, and then that balloon freezes down to about minus 80. And you kind of, in one shot, you freeze a whole circle of tissue around the ostium of these veins, and then you get the same effect. The signals can't get out. But first of all, instead of putting two catheters in here, you're only doing one. And if you have the choice of doing one needle-tipped catheter poking around in your heart or two, I would choose one. And in fact, complications rate are lower with this procedure. Procedure times are lower, and outcomes are better. So they did a trial that compared the two. They called it the fire and ice trial. Just came out 2 years ago. So radio frequency versus cryo. And you can see a lot of the outcomes were similar. So what they call the primary efficacy endpoint. So any recurrence of any tachycardia is similar between the two. But I do want to point out, if you look at the non-highlighted areas, so procedure times were lower, fluoroscopy times are lower, less x-rays, and this really makes a difference. You know, if you have a patient who's sick, who has chronic lung disease, heart failure, the less time on the table, the better it's going to be for them, obviously. So the primary outcome was very similar between those two, but I do want to show you some of the, in the sub-analysis, some of these outcomes. So you get less recurrences when you do this, okay? Cryoablation gives you less recurrences than the atrial fibrillation, the RF ablation. And, let me go back. So you can see here, fewer rehospitalizations, fewer recurrences and fewer cardioversions that they need, fewer need for repeat ablation. Historically, the number we quote patients is about 20 to 30% of patients with an RF ablation need a redo, because you go point by point around those veins, and if you miss by a millimeter, that's going to recur, and those patients need to go back. So 20 to 30% is sort of the historic number, and it's lower if you do it this way, because you do it in one shot, you freeze that whole circle, okay? This just shows you one of those maps that I showed you that electroanatomic map generates. And this just shows you what the problem is. You can do point by point, and we do like 100, 200 points of ablation, and you miss something like this, you get atrial fibrillation going through there, you get atrial flutters going through there. Patients are absolutely miserable, and they need redo procedures. So we were the second hospital in Utah to use cryoablation. The first one actually up here, Ogden Regional, is doing them as well. But we do almost all of our AFibs with the cryo. We're very happy with the procedure. I'd be happy to show you all of our recurrence numbers and so on. Everyone has some recurrences of atrial fibrillation, but we're very happy with our recurrence rates. And the number of times that we see a gap like this causing an atrial flutter and a problem is extremely low with the cryoballoon. So I am out of time. I did just want to leave you all with one more piece of information. We have a clinic at McKay called the RAFT Clinic, the Rapid AFib and Arrhythmia Treatment Clinic. Any patient that you have with an arrhythmia that you're worried about, we can get in and get them seen within 24 hours. We also have a hotline if you ask for the RAFT Clinic through the McKay D operator or call 801-387-RAFT. It goes to the cell phone of whichever of the three electrophysiologists is on call, myself, John Lund, or Dan, and you'll get a hold of us 24 hours a day. So if you have someone in your office and they're in a rapid AFib and you're not sure whether to send them to the ER or not, oftentimes a conversation with us can make things a lot easier because we can get them arranged for cardioversion the next day, get them taken care of, and spare your patient a trip and an overnight stay in the hospital. Okay? That's it. Any questions?
In your reoccurrence at the 6 month and 12 month out, were there any measurable lifestyle changes that affected that outcome and or medications, specifically ibuprofen use?
So in the trials that compared the outcome did not have detailed follow-up of they weren't the same trial, unfortunately. So do the patients with the earlier occurrence have a lower, would they have a lower quality of life scores is obviously the key question. It hasn't been tracked out so carefully in the same trials to really parse that out. I would presume the answer is yes, but I don't have data for that.
On the patient with intermittent atrial fibrillation, as a primary care physician, we put them on medications that are blood thinning medications with the idea that they're going to have less strokes, and then worry the whole time we take care of them that they're going to have a bleed someplace or another, particularly given the age of some of these patients. It's very tempting with intermittent atrial fibrillation to send them all to be ablated. Where do you draw the line?
Okay, so what you lose sleep over is what I lose sleep over. It's hard. The first of all, in terms of patients with paroxysmal atrial fibrillation, is their stroke risk lower? Common sense would tell you yes. The problem is no one has been able to find a lower limit for how much AFib you can have and still be safe. The newest data has come out, you know, the new pacemakers, we have remote monitoring on them. We can tell exactly how much AFib a patient has. With the data from the loop monitors that we put subcutaneously, same thing. It turns out the risk of stroke starts to increase somewhere at about 6 minutes a day of AFib. It's very, very little. So there's almost no lower limit to the AFib where you can say, oh, you're totally fine. So that's the first part of your question. When they've done studies and they look at patients who have AFib, so say, for example, you have a month of AFib in August. You don't have the strokes in August or September. Those patients, the timing of the strokes that they have is not really related to when they have the AFib. So unfortunately, that's a sort of very unsatisfying answer, and it's a very tough condition to manage, but once you have AFib, there's almost no lower limit to when you can really feel safe taking someone off anticoagulation. Common sense would tell you there should be a limit, we just haven't found it yet. So really the decision to put someone on a blood thinner is really based on their risk of stroke, based on like a CHADS VAS score and their comorbidities. The risk of bleeding is the scary part and is very hard. We have the HasBleed score, I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's again a scoring system and you can kind of tell it's not a great scoring system. It's not very accurate. So really, particularly for the older patients, it's, you know, a kind of careful conversation with the patient and their family. Anybody with a history of falls, things like that, you know, you have to, you know, have that conversation, and there's no sort of hard and fast rule. Now, does ablation lower your stroke risk is the other question, right? Should you send them for ablation? So because the risk of recurrence is high enough, there really is no hard data that ablation will lower your risk of stroke. So if someone comes to me with a high enough CHADS VAS score that they need anticoagulation, I don't take them off after the ablation just for that reason. There are some retrospective trials that say, oh, patients who've been ablated have a lower stroke risk, but that's all retrospective, and that's, you know, selection bias and all that. So no one does that at this point. So unfortunately, I don't have a very satisfying answer for you. There's really no way to to manage anticoagulation, you know, sort of easily in an older, frailer patient.
Over the last couple of years, at least within the biking community, there's concern with the master class endurance athletes having increased risk of atrial fibrillation. Is that concern substantiated? And if so, what are the best treatment options for them?
So the concern is substantiated. There's an increased risk of stroke in endurance athletes, and that risk, depending on the study, starts at about 6 hours or so of cardiovascular workout per week, okay? What to do about it? The answer is no one really knows. There's no, aside from some practitioners recommend their patients to reduce their burden, there's no evidence that reducing your burden will prevent more AFib, first of all. So if someone comes to you, they're an endurance athlete, a triathlete with AFib, will cutting back on exercise reduce it? The answer is that no one knows that answer, okay? The absolute risk is low. The increase is somewhere between a 50 and 100% risk relative to age and comorbidity matched controls. But in an otherwise healthy 50-year-old patient, the absolute risk of AFib is very low, okay? The prevalence in the population is under 1%. So even a doubling of that risk is not a huge increase, right? So the answer to what do you do, I don't have a great answer. Patients who are very symptomatic, we do ablations, we do things like that, but there's no proven intervention that will reduce it, okay? Because, you know, the truth is 99.5 of them don't get AFib. So why did that 0.5 get it? Is it just the exercise? No, it's probably the exercise plus they have certain predispositions in their heart to predispose them to it, right? So maybe they're going to get AFib anyway, and you're bringing it out early with the exercise. So I'll tell you, I'm a fairly data-driven guy, okay? And I think that when patients come to you, an endurance athlete comes to me, tells me he has AFib, the easiest thing to do is tell them, oh yeah, cut it back, you'll be fine. The truth is, we don't know that answer. And rather than just sort of dispensing advice without knowing, I tell them we don't know. You know, they can try to cut back and see if they get symptomatic improvement, but, you know, a 50-year-old guy who's passionate about triathletes, taking that away from them when I don't know that that's gonna help them, I don't think is really doing them any favors. Well, thank you so much.